Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we're going to venture into a spicier climb today and talking about what we never talked about before, Africa, South African cooking. Right? The first stop is actually, we've also never interviewed a professional dancer before, have we?
I don't know whether we have or not.
I don't know, but Natasha McAllar's book is called Spice Health Heroes, and I think it's a wonderful book for you to get a grip on the health and energy side of your life. I love these spices anyhow.
You got it, and then we're gonna come back to South Africa after that. But first up, what's the lady's name again?
We haven't been to South Africa yet. Natasha McAllar. I'm not surprised that Natasha McAllar's new book, Spice Health Heroes, is such a gorgeous production, because last time we talked to you was about a year and a half ago, and we were talking about The Vanilla Table, which you also wrote, and it was beautiful too. Natasha, you hit on something close to my heart in this one. Your Spice Health Heroes is like, I believe in this so strongly. Tell us about what you wanted to.
I wanted to show people that there is beauty in good food made from scratch, not complicated, but by adding a little bit of spice, different spices, not only enhances the flavor of the food, but can also provide benefit, nutritional benefit, health benefit. And it's a very, very inspiring and exciting discipline that's happening around the world, bit by bit, inch by inch. And I've combined medicine, Western medicine, with Eastern medicine, so the old and the new, with culinary, with chefs. And it's just been the most exciting journey that I've been on, this exciting adventure all around the world with spices.
Oh, yes, and you make a distinction between spice and herbs. I'm still not clear about that, but I was wondering, how do they measure the benefits of these spices in humans?
There are several ways that spices are measured in humans and in nutrition. There have been clinical trials, laboratory trials, and also the thousands of years of studies using herbs and spices as medicine, from Hippocrates to ancient India to China. All of these spices have benefit. These 30 spices in my book, in particular, my Spice Health Heroes, show exciting promise and benefit, and they've been used in traditional medicine and folk medicine, as I said, for thousands of years. And now it's starting to be recognized and tested and analyzed by the clinical, proper medical doctor community. And I'm finding lots of enthusiasm and some really exciting medical journals and papers that have been written about these different spices.
Well, I mean, I think they should quantify some things, though. I mean, like, how much are you supposed to ingest to get the benefits? And not all folk medicine is really on the mark. Think about elephant tusks and all the harm that's doing. And that does nothing whatsoever to increase a hormonal coup for men. And rhinoceros horns and stuff.
Oh, absolutely. And it's tragic what people think is an quote-unquote aphrodisiac.
Right.
Surprisingly, though, there is a spice that promising studies show. Fenugreek, believe it or not, is a bio-identical hormone. It's a hormonal balancer. It's said to increase milk production in new mothers.
Really? Fenugreek.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. And it has...
Peter's favorite potatoes are actually an Indian recipe that was a chef in Texas who was Indian, and she used the potatoes with fenugreek, and he's always raving about that.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So there are the spices that I've worked with here. I've been very, very careful. I've also recruited 8 medical doctors, proper clinical medical doctors, to work with. so that, when I talk about these spices and I use them in the various dishes in the chapters, as well as 21 contributing chefs from around the world, I have 8 medical doctors vetting every single spice, and with medical published medical journals. I've been reading a lot of medical journals. Oh my goodness, I've never read so many footnotes, but very exciting. The doctors have been very enthusiastic, very supportive, and there is a new, actually quite old, discipline called culinary medicine.
Oh,
and what I've done here is I've joined chefs and doctors working together and contributing together to create beautiful tasting food, but with bringing awareness to the reader about the benefits of a lot of these spices. We talk about turmeric. Turmeric is
everywhere. Oh, we're in love
everywhere.
With that. And I'm still in love with the fresh root.
Oh, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. Yeah. I use it in so many things in this book, and you can use it from a simple tea, and a tea infusion with, I use turmeric and star anise and some black peppercorn and some cinnamon, and you make this beautiful tea or tisane, which is from my understanding, that's a tea without using tea leaves.
Right.
And it's a lovely afternoon drink. You can, but always add a little bit of some sort of fat to the turmeric because that helps activate.
Oh, that was a
good
tip.
So
yeah.
Always a nut milk or an oil or
yeah,
or
I wanted to
milk.
Make sure Peter read that part of the book because we do a lot of the turmeric, and you do say you need to add a little fat to get it to perform.
Yes, you do. And you can see in the classic curry dishes, you know, the turmeric's always put in with a little oil, and it's cooked and sizzled. It also gives that amazing, distinctive aroma of turmeric, but that activates the curcumin.
Well, hold on just a second. I'm going to cook chicken thighs tonight. Now, is the fat that renders out of the chicken thighs enough fat to activate the turmeric?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Okay,
it just has
to be sure.
some kind of fat because it's fat soluble. It won't have any benefit if it's just in water or something that doesn't have a little fat. It could just be a couple drops of oil. It could certainly be chicken fat, anything like that.
No, I only have dried turmeric. I only have.
No, we don't have the root.
I don't have any turmeric root. No, I didn't think of using turmeric with the chicken until today. And I'm not going
we
to the store especially.
Yeah.
We did miss something out earlier on. We changed the subject before we got an answer to Anne's question. What's the difference between an herb and a spice?
I mean, an herb and a spice. Well, it's a great bone of contention with defining a herb and a spice. And I've defined it after doing much research and pondering. A spice can be a herb, but in the dried form. So dried rosemary, dried basil, dried mint. But it's also really great to have fresh herb spice in dishes.
You say the pomegranate is a spice.
Yes, it is.
See that.
It's called an aril, A-I-R-L.
Yeah.
Excuse me, A-R-I-L.
It's
there's a little seed, you know, the pomegranate seed bit, and then there's that lovely fleshy jewel garnet coating, and that is considered a spice. And then, of course, you have the rhizomes, you know, your ginger, your wasabi, horseradish, and turmeric, and berries, bark, flower buds, like hibiscus, like garlic is the bud, and those are all considered spices. So after much researching and analyzing, I've defined the spices in the introduction as to what a spice is versus a herb, but people will agree and disagree. So I made my stand.
Now you had a particularly interesting comment about coriander, which you say it sort of almost isn't fair that you can use it as a leaf and you can also use it as a seed.
Yes. Oh, and we know the great passionate opinions about coriander or cilantro leaf versus the seed.
You know, I heard that it was the cilantro that some people are predisposed to not be able to stand it.
Oh, yes, yes, absolutely. I have a friend who loved cilantro/coriander, because it's called coriander in different parts of the world, the leaf, and She, when she was pregnant with her first child, she became violently ill and can't go near it ever since.
Really?
Yes. Yes.
So odd.
It's fascinating. And yet the coriander seed is this sweet, nutty, beautiful little flavor and used in all kinds of things, all sorts of mixes. It's used in dukkha. It's used in, you know, your curries, your Indian blends. It's used in just a wealth of, and in Middle Eastern, it's just used in a wealth of blends and on its own. And it's got a lovely shape to it, and it's just lovely and sweet. So,
yeah, now you have actually, you open up the book with recipes for spice blends, which...
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, there's that man in New York, the chef, who has all these custom blends. Did you ever run into him? What's his name?
Yes, I have, and he's actually in my my sources page. On my sources page.
Well, we've interviewed him, and I mean, his cookbook was rather ingenious because he just calls for his blends by number, and you have no idea what you have to buy them from him.
Oh, very clever!
It
is. Great marketing. But he's very talented, and he has. I have seen his website. It's just. It's beautiful the way he's designed everything. I have a couple of chefs in the book. I have this extraordinarily talented female chef. As far as I know, she is the only 3 Michelin star female chef in the world. Her name is Anne Sophie Peake.
Oh, I know.
She does beautiful blends of
yeah. Now she opened a restaurant in New York. I thought she was going to. Or was it she was going to open it in London?
She's going to open in London now. So she was very generous in contributing this gorgeous red mullet fish dish with a saffron broth. It's absolutely beautiful, as all of her dishes are, just stunning.
Yeah, I don't want to do a correction, by the way. I mean, I'm not but be aware that Anne Sophie Peake was the most recent woman chef to be awarded 3 Michelin stars.
Yes,
but there were 3 before that. She became number 4.
Thank you for that.
There's one in Spain, just outside Barcelona.
Yeah,
called God, I can't remember her name now. there's a lady who's not really a chef. She's really a front of house person called Anna Fioldi at a restaurant in Florence.
And what about Arzak?
And then there's She's not getting stars on her own just yet.
Oh, okay.
There's another one somewhere. I can't remember where it is. Because Anne Sophie Peake made 4.
Well, I mean,
she made 4,
along.
And I've just recently read in the past couple of days a former chef of Gordon Ramsay is opening restaurant in London.
Right.
And I believe she has 3. Or she came from a 3 Michelin star.
She got
restaurant.
The 3 for Gordon Ramsay. What's
yes.
her name? You know who
yeah.
we're talking about. We're just not on it today.
My brain is fried.
Well, tell us this. Explain how you organize this book.
The one you're thinking of is Angela Hartnett.
Oh, yes.
Gordon Ramsay already had 3 stars long before that.
Right.
Yes. No, it's actually somebody new. I'll have to
okay.
look it up because I just saw it probably 4 days ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think there is a new chef there now.
Yeah.
Because she has her own places.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Annie, how did you organize this?
I organized the book. I looked at all of the qualities of all of the spices, reading not only history and myths, which I've included in the definition of each of the 30 spices, but also their health benefit and what they do. For instance, saffron is very calming. It's a natural sedative. It's been used in Greek teas for ages. They use the Greek mountain tea and then add a couple strands of saffron.
Yeah,
to it,
I started doing
calming.
That. And I decided it was too expensive for me.
Yeah,
to
I slept over there. I said, "Why is there never any saffron in the kitchen? quit drinking it all."
So we interrupted your explaining about how you organized the book, you're telling us also, I believe, how you got the titles for these spices, right?
Yes, through much. I love. I love banding around with words and formulating them and trying to capture what each spice would be. And turmeric, for instance, is the master spice. It's the spice that's included in so many different things, and it's the most studied, researched spice of these 30 spices. It's been studied for hundreds of years, starting in India, because people have turmeric there every day, and it's the most studied around the world. And so I call it the master spice, the benefits of anti-inflammatory, the benefit of, they've been doing studies on Alzheimer's with turmeric, with the Indian and the Asian population, because they include turmeric in their food every single day. And when you look at the Alzheimer's there versus in the Western world, it's far, far, far less. So a lot of studies are going on with that. So, and each of these spices has its own excitement and benefit that I've been reading and studying on. So I divided them into chapters, immune spice, which includes turmeric and cumin and star anise. And also then I have cleansing spice, things that help move through the body and help cleanse, and then energy spice, things that give energy, pepper and peppercorn, pepper meaning chili. And I've divided six spices into six chapters. Sorry, five spices into six chapters. That's it. Bad math, sorry. Mm-hmm. And I have restorative spice and calming spice. So these are all spices that can have benefit for those various ills, or if you want more energy, or you had a crazy, hectic day and you want something going to help soothe and have that moment of calm and cool and collected. So I divided them into these chapters and then just went from there and naming each spice, giving it a fun but beneficial name. Star anise, for instance, I call it the sultry fighter spice.
Yeah, I saw that one.
Because it's very, you know, star anise, the photograph that Manya, the photographer, took is absolutely stunning of star anise. I can't stop looking at it with all these beautiful star shapes.
And it's gorgeous to look at, period.
It's just beautiful. And the interesting thing with star anise, it's been around for thousands and thousands of years. It's grown primarily in southern China and in Vietnam. And the benefit that the Chinese found with star anise is that it helps. It's a flu fighter, and the science and production nowadays, believe it or not, a component, one of the active components in star anise is used in Tamiflu.
Oh yeah, it's not funny.
It's extraordinary. Funny. And turmeric, one of the components in turmeric is used in Tylenol. So it's going back to, what did we have before we had modern-day medicines? We had spices, we had herbs, we had all of these other things. And a lot of, I'm not, certainly not an expert, I'm just a chef, but a lot of modern-day pharmaceuticals are derived from spices, are derived from herbs.
Yeah,
so
but they always
exciting.
They always say that the bark of the trees in the Amazon could be the hold secrets for eradicating major diseases.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. No question. No question. So many things come from the Amazon.
Now, I want to say that we've been talking a lot about, I mean, the content of the book in terms of the benefits of these herbs or these spices, but I want to point out that the recipes for these dishes are also extraordinary. I mean, it's not a routine reference book on what spices have what benefits. I mean, there you have major chefs contributing really interesting and unusual recipes too. So that don't overlook, listeners, that it's also a cookbook, really. And could you, if you were to pick, I could tell you one thing I intend to make out of this is the pomegranate pistachio parfait. And Peter likes that, the lamb, the roast.
The lamb shoulder.
Lamb shoulder roast that we're going to make.
Oh, yes, those are excellent choices. They're some of my absolute favorites. I made the lamb shoulder for Christmas this year instead of a ham or a turkey, and it just filled the house with the most beautiful and drawing aroma. People kept coming to the kitchen going, "Oh my goodness, what is that? What is that?" And it's so simple. You just make a paste with these spices. You toast them and grind them and make a little paste with some oil, and you pat it on top of the lamb shoulder. And then I tuck some onion slices and some quince, and if quince is out of season, you can use apples, you can use pears, and just tucked it in there with a little bit of vinegar and water sprinkled on the top. Foil on top, into the oven, 4 hours.
Wow.
So simple. And
well, the answer is very simple, because Anne wants to talk to you for another 3 hours. But we don't have time for that in the program. Listeners, just buy the damn book. just buy the book. And I have one last question. Why the stars on some of the pages, and why the colors?
We try to simplify that. If you see the star, that's the spice hero. So at the top of, just above the title, it shows you what spices are starring in that particular dish. So if you say,
"Okay,
I want to use star anise, I've got some star anise, what can I do?" And you can just look through and you'll see the ones that include star anise.
Wow. Well, that's logical. And as I said, I mean, I couldn't hardly wait to try some of these recipes, Natasha. You've done it again. It's a great book.
Oh, thank
again,
you so
it's
much.
It's called Spice Health Heroes and Natasha McCullough. Is that how I used to pronounce it?
Yes, you pronounced it perfectly. And
great.
Thank you so much, Peter and Ann. It was a pleasure, as always, to talk to you. And I could talk with you for 3 hours easily as well.
Thanks, Natasha.
Thank you so much.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. The next guest is from South Africa, a special area of South Africa that she'll tell us about, Cape Malay. It's called My Cape Malay Kitchen, and her name is Kariema Isaacs. And it's very international, isn't it?
It is. It's really curious how it got transplanted from half a world away into South Africa. That in itself is a piece of interesting social history, and the cuisine itself is also very interesting.
I'm hoping I pronounced this correctly, Kariema Isaacs. Yes.
It's actually Kariema.
Kariema.
That's right.
Do I have it spelled correctly?
You have it spelled correctly, I'm sure.
Okay, so it's Kariema Isaacs. And the book is My Cape May Kitchen, My Cape Malay Kitchen. And I must say that Peter, you probably don't know this, but Peter has a master's in geography from Cambridge University. And so right away, my first question is, where exactly is this place? It's in South Africa, but pinpoint us to us more specifically.
Okay, so Cape Town's obviously in South Africa and at the most southern tip of South Africa. And the book is really centered around the area that I grew up in, or the area that I was born in, which also holds a very rich and I think very colorful past as well. So it's situated at on the slopes of Signal Hill, which is basically just above Cape Town, and it overlooks the city. And Signal Hill is right next to Table Mountain. And, of course, you know, the area that I grew up in, not only do you have a view of all of Table Bay and the harbor, but you also have all of these cobblestone streets that almost date back to the 18th century. So it's got a really, really rich history. And most importantly, I think it also holds one of the oldest Islamic communities in that part of Cape Town.
Right. Now, Peter was explaining to me about how you would have come to settle there. You meaning a Malaysian, Indian, Muslim, and so forth. What is your version of why did everybody end up there?
That's right. Well, as you would know, so as early as the, 17 and 1800s, the Dutch East India Trade Company was doing a lot of trade and actually established a trading post in what is now called Cape Town, which was called the Cape of Good Hope back then.
Right.
So in order for them to obviously do their trade, they had many slaves working for them, many of them coming from Indonesia, Malaysia, India, Sri Lanka, and various other African countries. And so my forefathers, most of them, or I think most work up residents actually, were descendants of the slaves who were basically imported from or by the Dutch from these countries that I've just mentioned. These slaves were also obviously then called Cape Malays at the time. Not all of the slaves and exiles that were in the Cape during that time were obviously from Malaysia, but predominantly those coming from Java, Indonesia, and Malaysia. You know, they made up the majority of the community. And so that's those are my forefathers, and with them came a rich history of the cuisine and spices that they used to cook with back home. Those were also brought over to the shores of the Cape. And with them coming to the Cape, they also introduced Islam, which predominantly also you'll find a huge Islamic influence in our cuisine as well. And so you will notice that if you go to any Cape Malay home, you won't be served alcohol or pork because it's obviously not part of our diet for religious reasons. But I think there's also an abundance of everything. So everything was shared by the community, and it's really because I think the slaves felt that they had one place in one area that they could actually socialize in and practice their religion as well, and that was quite important at the time.
Now, you've since moved away from South Africa, and I think you're talking to us today from the Middle East.
Dubai.
That's right.
What was it that prompted you to record your recollections, of growing up and eating this rather fascinating portfolio of foods?
I think the older one gets, you know, the more you kind of yearn for things that feel authentic to you and that feels like it's been a part of your life and maybe a part that you've missed also. So I had already been outside of South Africa for almost 7 years, and I think when I moved away from home, it was really difficult to find our traditional food in Dubai or in the Middle East. And I started, you know, I always loved cooking. It was always a part of, what I knew was familiar about home, coming home to cook meals, always being in the kitchen, sharing so many moments with my family in the kitchen or at the dinner table. And so when I moved to the Middle East, I started cooking more and more for my kids as well, just traditional stuff so that they could remember, you know, the food that we grew up with or the food that I grew up with that I could actually pass on to them. And that's probably one of the reasons that I have become so passionate and so proud of my heritage, because I also believe that, you know, Cape Malay food is not as as well showcased, I think, as other cuisines at the moment. So hasn't completely been discovered abroad. And it's, you know, it's got the same kind of vibrancy, I think, as Indian dishes as well.
So what would you conclude? First of all, I want to say that this book is really dedicated to the memory of your father, right?
Yes. That's true.
And you two shared the enjoyment of cooking and food together.
Yes, absolutely. I think any expat who lives abroad knows what it feels like, you know, to lose a family member and not be there for either the funeral or the person's passing. And I've now experienced that firsthand, and it was really devastating for me because, you know, we shared such a close-knit past together, and obviously was he was the center of my life for such a long time. So when I wrote the book, I just thought it would be, wouldn't it be just a wonderful gift to him to write a book about things that he so loved. And the, you know, the three things that have absolutely been the core of his life was, you know, the apart from his family, was his love for tradition and heritage, so where he grew up, what he learned, his religion, and then secondly, you know, just this, I think this, the enjoyment and celebration of food, because we always had people coming through our home, you know, sitting down and having a meal, and it didn't matter how much food we had. We always seemed to have an abundance of everything when people walked in, into our house. So when I wrote the book, I decided to write all of the recipes that we ate together and all of the ones that he taught me to cook. And obviously a lot of the traditional ones that we had on days when we were celebrating either Eid or Ramadan, or, you know, just a family celebration of a birthday or something like that. So the food in the book are all of the ones that he so loved. And we always used to cook while we were listening to music. He just loved
that was funny.
Everything from the 50s and 60s.
Oh, yeah, they were funny. I mean,
you read more of the book than I did. I mean,
Peter.
Who were the favorites? I think Paul.
Paul Anka.
Paul Anka. They called it Puppy Love.
Absolutely.
Neil Sedaka.
Absolutely. And you know, whenever he put on anything that Paul Anka sang, I could just see my mom's eyes sparkling, and she would be in the kitchen with us, and suddenly they'd hum together and sing together. And I have to believe that a lot of that love just permeated through the food, because by the time we sat down to eat, that meal would just taste, you know, delicious. You could just taste all the music in it, you could taste all the spices, so.
Oh, that's cool. You know, we're back to this. I sort of expected that it would be variations on Malaysian foods, but you point out a number of different influences on the cuisine of the, is it Bokap, Cape Town?
Yes.
And then you also put in things that had no relationship to the traditional food at all in these cookbooks. Tell us first about the influences on the traditional foods.
The influences, I think, on the traditional food really centers around, I think, where most of our descendants came from, and these were mostly, as I mentioned before, slaves coming from Indonesia and Malaysia, and I think in Indonesian cuisine itself has got such a rich Dutch influence, again because of trading that happened at the time.
You just read my mind, because I was going to mention that Indonesian restaurants still do that big feast, the Dutch feast, whatever it's called. You know what I mean?
Correct.
The what?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So go ahead.
Absolutely.
I didn't want to interrupt you, the influences.
No, so I was just going to mention that there's, you know, if you look at our cuisine, there's even some Turkish influence as well, and that again centers around, just around the Islamic influence again from the Turkish side. So you'd also pick up that even if you look at our traditions on a Sunday afternoon, I still remember my grandmother who'd at 4 o'clock, it would be 4 o'clock tea, and there would be a tablecloth on the table. She would have baked some sort of a cake, you know, whether it was a loaf cake or a Victoria sponge, but it was a cake that we would have on the table with cake forks out, and we'd always have tea, so it would be tea, and you couldn't have it in a mug, it had to be in a cup and a saucer,
mm-hmm.
And I again think that's the British influence, because she also worked at the Mount Nelson Hotel, so there was a lot of what she saw at the hotel being served to British guests at the time. And she would always come home and say, you know, the Queen Mother is visiting in a couple of months' time, and so the menus have been changed this month. So I think there's a bit of that influence as well, and then there's French influence as well. So it is really, I think, just a melting pot of sort of influences that we've really made our own. And so our curries, for instance, wouldn't be an authentic Indian curry. It is an Indian and a Malay curry, where on the Malay side it's slightly sweeter and not as pungent and spicy as a Indian curry. And then obviously on the Indian side you still have that little bit of heat, but it only really comes through either through adding a chili or a little bit of a roasted masala.
Now, if listeners across we have listeners across the globe, so we're talking to people who perhaps have never even thought about going to South Africa, but maybe they thought about it and they've thought, well, it's a long way away, and maybe I won't know what the food is like. I mean, will people who visit South Africa today, will they be able to find this kind of food, this Cape Malay kitchen type food in restaurants in South Africa?
Yes, they would, for sure they would. I think it's become more popular now. In fact, Cape Malay curries are being sought after. You would always find them on menus if you do go to Cape Town. You'll find, so curries are extremely popular. The more traditional dishes you won't. You might find these in, probably restaurants that are centered around that area in Boerkop or the Cape Malay Quarter. But as far as the curries and also the cakes go, a lot of that you will find in restaurants as well. I think what's also I think what I also like about Boerkop at the moment is because there are so many tourists just flocking in, you know, to get a view of the city and to understand the heritage and culture. A lot of Cape Malay housewives have now actually started, talking about our cuisine and the history of the spices and where they come from. And so you could even have a homemade dish by one of the ladies who actually lives there, so the resident would actually cook for you, and you could obviously have your meal there as well. But a lot of restaurants in Cape Town do serve Cape Malay meals. It's just the more traditional ones you might not find on the menu.
Now, you know, I was looking because I once wrote an article for a magazine on the foods of Ramadan, and I found out that spread out across the globe, they had nothing in common from one culture to the next, except for one element, the exchange of dates. Now, I couldn't find any date-centric recipes. Are there in your book?
I think I have one, which is basically a date and walnut loaf, something that my dad absolutely adored having on the weekend, especially with his, so that you would see. I think one of the reasons that you wouldn't necessarily see a lot of date recipes in Cape Malay cuisine is because dates were not as abundant as they are now. you know, unlike the Middle East where they actually grow them here, and I mean, I see it used in food, I see it used in cakes, I see it used in desserts, and even in drinks as well. Whereas back home, we actually see dates as you know, it's, I won't say it's scarce because you can find it in shops, but I think at the time when I was growing up, we really saw it as something almost sacred and something to have only during Ramadan. And so it was never really eaten, you know, outside of that period. It was also something that the pilgrims sort of brought back from Mecca with them. And so this was really the only time that you would actually have gotten dates at that time. But I think now it's more sort of abundant, and it's been fused into the more modern recipes as well.
Well, I mean, this is all fascinating, Grandma. I mean, it's something totally new to me, and I congratulate you on producing this book, and I'm sure your father would be really proud of you and of this book. So,
thank you so much. I cannot tell you how just... you know, amazing this journey has been. I think I've gone from heartache to completely falling in love with him again. And so, you know, I've had so much feedback about the book, but I think essentially it's just a legacy I wanted him to have, and I wanted him to, you know, his legacy to actually be remembered. And I never for one moment thought that I'd be speaking to someone in the U.S. about, you know, about my dad, about our heritage, about our culture and our cuisine. Never thought it would happen. So thank you so much for allowing me to speak to you and your listeners.
Well, thank you.
Sounds to me like it might be time for a song.
Neil Sedaka.
I definitely think so.
Oh, dear. Well, thank you again, Karima.
You're most welcome. Take care. Thank you so much for having me.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
You know, I feel bad that we've never been to South Africa since we even have relatives there. But I don't know why we never go. But anyway, we know what the food's going to be like because we just talked to Melinda Root, who is tireless from what I could gather from so much that she does. She's going to talk to us about the classic South African food. We're going to be talking again about, we seem to be talking a lot about South Africa. This book, however, is very different from the My Malay Kitchen. It's called The Classic South African Cookbook, and Melinda Root is the author. Melinda, what do you do in your spare time?
I have actually so many things that I do in my spare time. I'm a busy body.
Well, I mean, just why I asked that question is, I mean, you and your husband, Gerard, are senior pastors at the Delta Community Church in, how do you pronounce that,
Vereeniging.
Yes.
Vereeniging.
And she is a native, a South African, born and bred with long roots. But she does everything. She has cooking classes. She does all this volunteer work on boards of charitable organizations for abused women or children or the crime victims, orphanages and so forth and so on, which you'd think would be a full-time occupation at that, but on top of that, she's a musician, oversees and leads three bands. I mean, this is amazing. That's only the start of it. She has a cooking school, and she does conferences, public speaking, and then when she has free time, apparently she rides, because I saw you have pictures of your horses in this book, And you take painting commissions. I mean, that's an awful lot to chew. How do you manage to do all that?
Luckily we don't do it all at once. But I think, having a heart for the community work and the cooking school has actually sprouted from that. To influence the community in a better way, that our communities can grow and families can grow and flourish, that is mainly our aim, to see that families grow healthy, like little healthy hubs. And our focus is to empower people, especially with the cooking schools, has been my focus, to empower people to cook good home cooking. You know, in the days that we live, we actually don't have time to spare. And I found that a lot of young people that actually work 9-to-5 jobs come home, and the easiest way to put supper on the table is by stopping for fast food.
Sadly, Melinda, it's the same the whole world over.
Yes.
And here no less than anywhere else.
Well, you know, the daughter of a friend of ours has three children and a very successful husband, busy, a gorgeous, huge house in a very fancy neighborhood, and meals at their houses. She puts a bunch of things on a table, and the kids sort of get to walk by and pick something to eat if they want to from the table.
Please.
Yes. And it's not even carry out. Yeah, I don't know what you'd call that. Grazing, I guess.
It's true. And, you know, I think to get the family back together again, I know it's impossible to do it every day of the week, but even if we can start by doing it over weekends, to get your family around the table and have good laughs and good conversations, to look one another in the eye. And what better way than to do it with food?
Yeah, you seem to like breakfast a lot. I mean, some of these foods for breakfast are huge. I mean, I would never think of that first thing in the morning.
Well, we are South African. We are really big on breakfast. Uh-huh. And we do love eggs and meat for breakfast, unlike America that goes for donuts and pastries. We really like protein for breakfast in South Africa, which gives you a good start for the day.
It's called
a full South African.
Full South African, right?
a full
Afrikaans, yeah. Or a full Dutch.
A full, now tell me,
a full Afrikaans breakfast, yes.
Yes, but tell me this. I mean, when I'm reading this cookbook, you've addressed some of that already. It seems to me that, okay, it's supposed to be a classic South African cookbook, but the recipes to me are solid international cuisine with influences from everywhere.
Yes, and South Africa has influences. We've got a very diverse culture. We started off with the settlers and the pure South Africans, which we do have a lot of influence from our African culture when we look at all the maize dishes and the stews and like lamb liver and kidneys and obviously you know that braai or barbecue in South Africa, we love our meat.
Oh, I wanted that. I didn't know what that was. Now you've defined it for me. Is that you pronounce it bride?
Braai.
Braai.
It's like an American barbecue, but we usually do it on an open fire with either wood or charcoal, and then big chunks of meat. Good steaks, lamb chops, any kind of meat. Meat is big in South Africa. And it derives from the African culture as much as we've got influences from our forefathers that were settlers from France and then also from the Netherlands and from Germany.
And Italy.
And then there's a lot of people that actually started coming out in the 19th century to South Africa from the Mediterranean. We've got a lot of Portuguese-speaking people. We've got a huge Italian community. We've got a huge Italian, not Italian, but Greek community as well. So we really have such a diverse culture, and it has really over the years influenced South African cooking that purely came from Malaysian Afrikaans and African cooking. All of these cultures influenced it to a modern South African cooking, and that is initially, you know, why we started the book with all of these cultures, because it is part of our daily living here. Nowadays, a pizza is just as well known as a, you know, a family cooked meal, because it's part of our culture. We've been influenced by that.
Now, some of these dishes, I have no idea what they are, like malkos or sam.
Okay, now malkos, yes, malkos is like, the direct translation to English is milk food. It is a milk porridge that is made with flour and eaten with a lot of cinnamon sugar on top of that. And our forefathers used to make it. I remember my granny used to make it in the evening when we've, for instance, had a big lunch, and it is a cold winter's evening. You make this milk porridge, and it's got this wonderful cinnamon sugar topping that melts away into the milk porridge, and it is so warming. It's like a soup, but a milk-based soup, and you just have that for dinner, and it is fulfilling, and it is warm. That is typically South African.
What about samp?
Samp is like whole corn that is cooked as you cook rice, but it takes a bit longer than rice. I find that we cook it in a slow cooker and over 2 to 3 hours, and it's a good substitute for rice, especially with good stews like an oxtail stew. It really complements the beef in oxtail stew, but it is derived from a corn cob. It comes from a corn cob, and it is kept whole. It's not crunched like with when you make a meal. It is kept whole and then cooked soft like a rice.
How about boboti?
Okay, boboti is that is from our Malaysian culture. If I can explain it to you in the easiest way, it is closest to the American meatloaf. It is made with minced beef, but it's got a curry base, curry and turmeric. It is a lovely, lovely, tasty dish. It's got a bit of a curry background, and you can have a fruited chutney with that and rice served with that. I think in my mind's eye, it's the closest thing that we have to American meatloaf. It is also baked in the oven with an egg custard, and then it becomes firm. And you can cut it in squares, but it is a meat.
Now, it's interesting. You haven't mentioned any influence from my native land and the native land of quite a large segment of the South African population. But it is, that influence is clearly manifest in the section on desserts.
Yeah.
there's a big time pudding section.
And which country is that?
I was born and raised in England.
In England. There is quite a few things that comes from England. Firstly, the scones for breakfast.
Right. Oh, scones for breakfast. Okay, yeah.
Yes, we do have it for breakfast sometimes, and sometimes for tea. Yeah. And then, you know, the old bangers and mash. That is so well known in England.
You have that
now,
here.
In South Africa.
Is that in there?
In South Africa, we don't have bangers, but we have boerewors, which is a beef sausage, a spicy beef sausage, instead of the bangers.
Okay, all right.
And then there's that thing that looks like shepherd's pie, which you call it something different. It has mashed potatoes on it.
Yes, exactly. So the shepherd's pie also comes from England, and that was also taken, and it's very well known. I think every South African person knows the shepherd's pie because we've all eaten it. It's a well-known dish in our homes.
Now, I had one question of I dissent over your béarnaise sauce, because the essence of béarnaise sauce, the classical sauce, is tarragon, and you don't have that in here. You've just chopped
yes,
herbs.
And I actually just left it out. I know tarragon is a main ingredient, but it is not always readily available, especially out in the, in the rural areas. We can't always get hold of tarragon, and I had to use an ingredient that actually will be available to everybody to make it easier for the normal South African home.
Now, if all these recipes, take them all together, could you point out a couple that you think are very characteristic of the South African kitchen?
Definitely from the South African kitchen, oxtail stew. That is one of our favorites. Milk tart. I don't know if you know milk tart, but
right.
You've seen in. That is definitely South African. It is a milk-based tart, but it's lovely to have. It's like a milk custard, and it sits in the fridge, and it has a wonderful cinnamon topping. Really South African is pumpkin fritters that you can either have with also with cinnamon sugar, or there's a caramel sauce, so you can choose whichever you would like with that. Definitely South African is ginger biscuits.
Oh, yeah.
And soot cookies. Now, soot cookies is just like a sugar biscuit, and it's very well known. Every home has it. The aniseed rusks that we have right at the end, you can eat it fresh, like as it is in the loaf in the picture, like a bread. You can have it immediately and serve it as a bread with coffee. And then you can dry it out in the oven and use it as a rusk. Now, in South Africa, we do like our rusks to it's just like a mid-morning or mid-afternoon snack that you can have with coffee or tea, just as a filler.
Yeah, now I forgot to mention, add to your list of things you do and your accomplishments, that you also run a company that sells rusks and biscuits.
Yes, I actually had a small biscuit label, Mouse Kitchen, that I've run over the past 2 years, and I have recently given it over to one of the young ladies in our congregation for her to give her a start out with her own little company.
Oh, nice. That's very sweet.
Yes.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess I have to ask you what a mealy pap is.
Okay. Mealy pap is your South African cornmeal for Italians, and especially in America, you will know it as polenta. But
okay.
In South Africa, we do not use a yellow corn, but we use white
corn.
Maize.
Okay.
Yes, which is called maize in South Africa. And that is one of our nation's staples. Much more than bread and potatoes. Maize is a staple all over Africa. And we have tried quite a few recipes with that. And I did a mealy pap tart that is actually like a polenta bake with tomato and onion and mushrooms in between and grilled cheese and a little bit of bacon as well. Which is a very nice starch to go with your normal South African braais when you have like steak or lamb chops that you barbecue. We serve that as a starch and a salad.
It's interesting, Melinda. We have a dish very popular in the southern United States called grits. It sounds a lot like grits.
Okay, well, it just goes to show that I think we all try to do a few different things with that mealy meal or with a maize meal. And obviously, we have the different dish to that was, we call it crumble pop,
which is you cook the maize meal with a little bit of water, and it forms a crumbly texture. And you can either have that with milk and sugar for breakfast, or you can have that with like a stir-fry onion and tomato-based sauce. And they also serve that with barbecued meat and a salad. And it is a firm favorite in South Africa because it is a staple.
Well, it's wonderful to think about this. What I'm going to conclude is that if you go to South Africa, and everybody tells us we should, it's a wonderful place to visit. You also may be sure, listeners, that you won't be hungry.
No.
No, definitely not.
Melinda,
love our food.
Melinda, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. It's fascinating to hear a South African English accent once more.
Thank you. It's been a privilege to speak on the program, and I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Melinda.
Well, there you have it. Another program, another Sunday, bloody Sunday, or whatever they say. Why is it that Al Roker always says that funny thing about Sunday?
It's Sunday in America.
No, but he always says Sunday.
I don't know.
Maybe we should adopt that for On the Menu Radio.
Well, because you can hear it at any time. I hope people don't think that you could just hear it at one time on Sunday or on any Sunday. You
probably
can hear it all the time.
He'd probably soup.
24/7 every day of the year for 14 years. You could listen to On the Menu Radio.
So we'll be surprised if we don't see you again, same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye bye.